Case number 20-6014, Springstone, Inc. v. Hiscox Insurance Company, Inc. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Vance for the appellant.
Afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Gene Vance on behalf of Springstone, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The district prematurely terminated this litigation by failing to correctly apply the 12B6 standard, by disregarding facts pleaded in Springstone's complaint, and by incorrectly interpreting the policy at issue in this case. Springstone's well-pleaded complaint clearly states claims for coverage under both coverages B and C of the insurance policy at issue. But what I'd like to do first is turn to an argument that the district court erroneously dismissed out of hand. Coverage C of this policy expressly provides Springstone with coverage for a written demand for monetary relief. And indeed, Hiscox concedes as much. The key TAM complaint in this case itself is clearly a written demand for monetary relief. The district court spent two paragraphs on this issue with no citation to authority and no citation to the correct portions of the policy. And it concluded that the key TAM complaint was made as of the date it was filed. That is just wrong.
Well, can I, just to let you know, my elaborating on that, it didn't seem wrong to me. And the reason I didn't think it seemed wrong was the word made. And I found myself thinking, true enough, you didn't know about it, but that's just a function of what the time period is for the insurance policy. So it might be the case that if you don't know about something, there's no statute of limitations bar, there's a discovery rule, but I don't see anything inherently unfair about saying the policy that applies is the one in place at the time the QTAM lawsuit was filed, whether you knew about it or not. I mean, the point is, presumably you have coverage the whole time.
Well, Judge, that ignores the distinction between an occurrence policy and a claims-made policy. This is a claims-made policy. And in order to make a claim under a claims made policy, you have to know that the claim exists. Think about the medical malpractice context where we most often, or any type of professional negligence, where you most often see a claims made policy. If a surgeon is performing surgery, you're not going to know necessarily at the moment in time that there was a sponge left inside the body cavity. You're not going to know it until sometime later when there's a complication that manifests. And those policies are designed so that when you know about the claim, that is the policy that is implicated.
What about the word made? What about the word made or made?
Well, that is where we look to the language of the policy here. To make a claim, Springstone has to know that it exists. And that's what the policy says. Knowledge of the claim came with the subpoena. And Springstone reported the subpoena to Hiscox. And here's the really significant part about that. Springstone wrote a letter denying coverage, which we believe is incorrect. But within that letter, they said that we are going to treat this as a notice of circumstance that may result in a claim if further information comes available that relates to this incident that you have reported to us. And that's exactly what the QTAM complaint is when Springstone learned about it. It is a subsequent development that under even Hiscox's definition, matured into a claim at that point under the relation back clause in the policy and as stated in the letter that Hiscox sent to Springstone. Now, Hiscox pushes back on that and tries to say that, well, it was not served. That's really their only argument response is that
did
it wasn't
you, did your client have did your client have coverage during the time when the QTAM claim was filed?
Judge, that's not part of the record in the case, and I don't know the answer to that question, but regardless, what the district court is confined to are the allegations in the complaint, and the record may well be fleshed out further through discovery, but that's not something that was raised or considered below.
How was the claim made in this case that you say put to the claim?
The claim arose when Springstone received a subpoena from the Office of the Inspector General, the Department of Health and Human Services. All parties agree that that subpoena was directly related to this QTAM action. Springstone had no idea there was a QI-TAM action at that point in time because it was still sealed, hadn't been served, hadn't been unsealed.
But that doesn't necessarily make it a claim, does it? I mean, doesn't correct. A claim have some... Take your malpractice thing. Somebody does something wrong, maybe not the sponge case, but something else, and they request the medical... Somebody requests the medical records. Is that a claim, or is it when they either notify the hospital they're going to sue and turn it over to your insurance company, or in fact sue, that becomes a claim?
Judge, it has to be some indication that a claim is being asserted. And in this instance, it's different from
A subpoena doesn't necessarily show that a claim is being asserted. It shows somebody's investigating.
It also, in this instance, specifically says that there is an investigation related to a False Claims Act case. And so the subpoena itself, we believe, is covered under coverage B of the policy, whereas the ETAM complaint is covered under coverage C. And I can turn to coverage B and talk about the fact that the subpoena itself meets the definition of a claim under the policy because it is a written demand for non-monetary relief against an individual insured. District Court erred in its conclusion with respect to that issue. Firstly, in concluding that there was no individual insured identified. That's not correct. It disregards Springstone's factual allegations. Again, we're talking about at the 12B6 stage. This subpoena expressly requests information from Springstone employees, executives, board members. Those are individual insurers. What the district court
You said the subpoena expressly mentioned all those entities?
It does. 10 of the 28 demands in the subpoena, Judge, reference employees, executives, or board members. What the district court and Hiscox try to read into the policy that it doesn't say is that those individuals have to be named. There's nothing in the policy that says that names have to be attached to those individual insureds. We're talking about positions, and that is sufficient to be able
What should I make about the fact that it's a D&O policy? I mean, the reason it's got this stuff about naming individuals, you would think, is it's a D&O policy. And that's about directors and officers, of course, and you know, indemnification of directors and officers. That's the whole point of this. So why isn't that explain why we're having troubles with the, you know, square peg round hole here?
Well, I don't think it's a square peg round hole. It depends on what you believe or what you believe the definition of the hole is, Judge. There's nothing in the policy that says that the hole has to be hole A, hole B, hole C. The hole can be an employee, an executive, a board member. And if Springstone wanted to exclude coverage for a class of people, they could have said that, but they didn't. In fact, they defined individual insureds to include executives, employees, and board members.
Did the subpoena list the names of the people that it was investigating?
The subpoena itself did not, Judge, but it was certainly targeted on particular categories of employees. And then you also have to take into account the fact that the QI-TAM complaint, which, as we've noted earlier, relates back and forms a basis for the claim, does name individual employees. And that's another aspect of the case that Springstone did not get the opportunity to more fully develop because the court short-circuited this case before it even got beyond the complaint stage. And that's
Springstone didn't know who was named at all until it was uncovered, right? Or until the subpoena came out.
Springstone did not know who was named in the QI-TAM complaint that was unsealed. Springstone did know who the individuals were that fell within the categories of individual insureds that are listed in the subpoena. And in fact, as a part of its investigation that it conducted in response to that subpoena, Springstone identified those. There's an exhibit to the complaint that indicates that these were the category or the people, specific people. And the district court disregarded that. It said, well, I'm not going to pay any attention to that because that's an email from Springstone's lawyer. Well, that doesn't make any difference. It might make a difference at the summary judgment phase. That's all we can come up with. But it doesn't make any difference here because we're at the 12B6 stage, and we need to have the opportunity to flesh out these plausibly pleaded claims that we have set forth in this complaint. So it is clear that the individual insured provision does not read the way that Hiscox would like it to read. The other piece that they want to argue is this is not a demand for relief. It is a demand for relief, and we've relied upon the Oceans case for that purpose and others. In fact, virtually every court that has considered that issue on facts similar to this type of case has made the decision that this falls, this is a written demand for non-monetary relief.
Does Frank Stone claim it, it's indemnified any of these employees?
Yes, sir, it certainly has. In conducting the investigation and gathering the information, that is most certainly action that Springstone took, not only on its own behalf, but on behalf of the employees and the executives and the board members. So there is indemnification. Springstone goes far and far afield in its, Hiscox goes far afield in its brief on that point, talking about, well, there's no indemnification agreement. We don't have anything of that nature. The policy doesn't require any of that. It's reading requirements into the policy that are not there. And I might add that Kentucky law is particularly favorable to insureds in coverage issues like this. And you really can see that in the decision Hiscox wants to rely upon from an unpublished decision from a panel of this court, the ProMedica decision, where there is a determination that there is no coverage and the citation of Ohio law. And then you look at another opinion that Judge Gibbons wrote in a case called Auto Club versus BT, same judge, different law. And you look at the extensive amount of authority in Kentucky that says that if there's any doubt, if there's any ambiguity, if there's a tie, all of that goes to the insured. And that is what we make clear in our demands in this case, in the factual statements in the complaint. And we believe that when you look at the plain language of the policy, it is clear that there is coverage under Part C for the QTAM complaint because it relates back under the language of the policy and the letter that Springstone wrote. There is coverage under B for the subpoena, and there's also coverage for the defense.
Well, what's your authority, best authority for the made in subpoena, that's the time, that the subpoena counts? What's your best case for that? Any court of appeals case?
Well, there are cases, Judge, that say that on the made issue, and this is specifically related to the type of claims made policy, that
your point is it's the time of the subpoena,
because
right?
That's when Springstone knew about the claim.
I got it. I'm asking you for cases.
Well,
what is there besides the Nevada District Court case?
There's a case out of Delaware that Springstone cited, or I'm sorry, that Hiscox cited, called Medical Depot versus RSUI Insurance, that specifically held that an unserved QTAM complaint is a claim, and that's what we have here, and it relates back to the date of the initial notice. That was the issue in that case, and that was what the court.
And then you call the subpoena the claim?
The QTAM complaint is a claim that relates back to the notice that came from the subpoena. And yes, the subpoena is a claim. We make that argument as well.
Okay, I got it. Okay, I got it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll hear from Mr. Duffy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Duffy from Peabody and Arnold on behalf of Hiscox Insurance Company. Your Honors, we believe that the decision of the district court case dismissing this action was correct and that it should be affirmed. The district court properly applied the correct test on a motion to dismiss. Under the Ashcroft and Twombly cases, the court is supposed to disregard legal conclusions stated in the complaint, assume the pleaded facts to be true, and then determine whether the complaint alleges sufficient factual matter to state a claim which is plausible on its face. And applying this standard to the facts alleged in Springstone's complaint, it does not set forth a claim which is plausible on its face. All of the relevant documents, which is the policy and the subpoena and the related correspondence, it was all attached to the complaint. And so the court properly considered those documents on a motion to dismiss without converting it to a motion for summary judgment. And reviewing those documents, there simply was not a plausible claim for relief set out here. Now, with respect to coverage B, coverage B is captioned company reimbursement coverage. And coverage B here is not implicated by the subpoena for three different reasons. And number one, coverage B only applies to a claim against an individual insured. And there were no claims against individual insureds here. What we have here is a subpoena.
Why not say, as your friend on the other side says, that, you know, no one's named, but clearly corporations work through individuals, and the subpoenas did mention different types of employees. Why shouldn't that suffice?
Because it's not a claim made against an individual. To say that it's a claim, they have to say that it's a demand for relief, non-monetary relief. And a subpoena served on the company seeks documents from the company. It's not as if there were any individual subpoenas here. There was never an individual subpoena here. We're talking only about a subpoena that was served on the company, and it's addressed to Springstone Inc., care of Springstone's corporate keeper of the records.
Do you claim that the claim was made when the lawsuit was filed? The key town.
Our position is that no claim was ever made. That's our position.
There was no claim.
The option is that there was no claim as defined in the policy. Now, but look, if we're talking about the subpoena is not a claim because it is not a demand for non-monetary relief. And the ProMedica case, which is decided by a different panel of this court, is exactly 1,000% on point here. It's the same policy language. It's exactly the same issue.
The plan covers a request to waive the statute of limitation. Why isn't that analogous to answering a subpoena in terms of the word relief?
Because there was no request to waive the statute of limitations in this case.
That's a good answer. It doesn't answer the question I was asking, but it's a good answer. The reason I was asking the question is, isn't that a sufficient analogy? In other words, it shows don't be too technical about the word relief.
No, because this court, a different panel of the Sixth Circuit, looked at this exact question in ProMedica, and they talked about what is the common meaning of the word relief. And the court in that case specifically held that a subpoena seeking documents is not seeking relief. And so Springstone is really asking you to rule in this case that ProMedica was wrongly decided. Panel of this court.
That of course was a non-published case. It's true there's some other court of appeals cases that help you. There are quite a few district court cases going the other way, however.
There is a split of authority on this around the country. We acknowledge that. We address all the cases in our brief. We think we can distinguish the cases going the other way. But, you know, I acknowledge there is a split of authority here. We believe that the ProMedica case and the Muscle Farm case and the Biomedics case, all of which are Court of Appeal decisions, are the ones with the correct analysis. Because an investigative subpoena seeking documents is trying to find out whether something happened. It's not a demand seeking relief for an actual or alleged wrongful act. That's the fundamental difference here. What if
Springstone quite cleverly had answered the subpoena, convinced the government there was nothing there, and just before the government was about to drop the whole thing, they said, well, we would like to confess as to one email, probably was a little too close to the line, admit guilt, we will pay $100 in light of this mistake, and here's the name of the individual who made the mistake. Would they then be able to collect all these attorney's fees?
No, not necessarily, because they would still have to identify a claim. And to identify a claim in that situation, they would still have to identify some writing from the government which accuses that particular individual of doing something wrong and seeks relief as a result of that. And if that happened, and this is all hypothetical because it never did happen.
All right, change my hypothetical. They just asked the government lawyer, do you mind just mentioning Joe Smith? Because Joe Smith hypothetically has this one email that's a little too close to the line. We don't mind if you charge him, we'll give you $100. It's pretty minor. Then they get coverage for all these fees, right?
No, I mean, just mentioning Joe Smith is not enough. If the government alleges that Joe Smith did something, they could potentially get legal fees from that point forward. But you don't get fees that are incurred prior to the date on which a claim is actually made.
I'm just making the point. It seems very formalistic. I mean, I realize law is formalistic, but that's, I guess, the only point I'm making.
Yeah, and maybe law is formalistic, but it's still, it's a matter of contract. And we have to interpret the language of the policy. And there's no coverage for a subpoena, at least according to the ProMedica case and the other Court of Appeal decisions, because an investigative subpoena is trying to find out if something happened. It's not seeking relief for an alleged wrongful act because it doesn't allege that anything happened. And, you know, there are other problems with coverage for the subpoena under B, and that is that this is reimbursement coverage. It only applies if you indemnify an individual. And it's undisputed here Springstone is looking for its own legal fees. And we talk about the meaning of indemnification. We cite some Kentucky cases in our brief. And it means reimbursing a third party for some harm suffered by the third party. There's no plausible argument that Springstone paying its own legal fees is indemnifying somebody else. They're paying their own legal fees for their own purposes.
Now, counsel, maybe you've already said this or responded to it, but counsel on the other side raised this point with the QTAM action that there's a difference between an occurrence-based policy and a claims-made policy. I'm just curious how you respond.
There is a difference, but this is a claims-made policy, and it only includes coverage when there is a claim that's made during the policy period. Now, here we have a QTAM case that was filed before the policy period.
Judge Seiler has a question.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
Mr. Vance said that the company indemnified these insured people. Do you disagree with that, or you agree that it did that?
We do not agree with that. And in fact, it's pretty clear that that's not what happened. What happened here is that Springstone was served with a subpoena. Springstone paid its own legal fees, and that's all that it paid. What Springstone's arguing is that by paying its own legal fees, it actually was indemnifying other people. But that's not the way it works. If you're paying your own legal fees, you're paying your own fees. You're not indemnifying somebody else.
You're saying that was payment for corporate fees, not for individual fees. That's what
correct. Correct. The subpoena was served only on the corporation, and the attorneys were representing the corporation, responding on behalf of the corporation to the government. So that is not the indemnification of an individual. I also want to briefly address the QTAM case. And Springstone now criticizes the district court for assuming that the claim was made when it was filed. But the point here is that in the district court, Springstone was the one arguing that the QTAM case was made when it was filed. They cited case law saying that an unserved complaint is a claim. And so Springstone now is asserting as reversible error the fact that the court agreed with an argument that Springstone was making. And you can't do that. It's called the doctrine of induced error. If you invite the court to do something, you can't complain on appeal that the court did what you invited it to do. And they cite case law at pages 19 and 20 of their brief in the district court, which says that an unserved complaint is a claim. So, and that's all that the judge did. The judge agreed with them. And now they're claiming that that's reversible error. What they're saying now is an argument that was never made in the district court. They never argued in the district court that the QTAM case is a case that was made against Springstone in 2019. That's totally new, and it's not properly before the court on appeal. But it's also totally wrong on the merits, because by the time they found out about the QTAM case in 2019, it had already been dismissed. It was never served, and it was dismissed voluntarily before Springstone even knew that the case existed. So what Springstone argued before is that an unserved complaint could still be deemed to be a demand for relief. But by the time they found out about it, it was already dismissed. By the time they found out about it, nobody was demanding anything. The case was over. And there is no case law at any level, which says that finding out about a case after it's already been dismissed constitutes the making of a claim against the insured at that point. The case from Nevada that they rely on is on a totally different issue. It has nothing to do with when a claim is made. It involves a prior pending litigation exclusion. And the issue in that case was when is a lawsuit deemed to be pending? Now, that's a different issue from when a claim is deemed to be made. But in any event, the result in the My Left Foot case was that the court said that the claim was not pending until it was served. In this case, the Quitiam case was never served. So if we agree with My Left Foot and say that an unserved complaint is only a claim when it's served, what that would mean is that the Quitiam case, in this case, was never a claim because it was never served. And that's not disputed. So there simply is no authority in support of a view that discovery years later of a case that's already over, when nobody's demanding anything, involves the making of a claim against the insured at that point. The other point I want to make there is that even if they were right that the claim was made in 2019, and I think they're not, they would only get legal fees incurred from that point forward. And they weren't any because the case is already over. And the case exactly on point there is the Office Depot case from the 11th Circuit that we cite in our papers. And that's a very analogous situation. It's a case where there was a notice of circumstances within the policy, and then at some point years later, a claim was actually made. And the claim related back based on the earlier notice. But what the 11th Circuit said is that even when you have relation back governs which policy controls which policy governs. It does not create coverage for fees that are incurred before a claim is actually made. So you have to look at when is the claim actually made, if it ever was. And if Springstone is right that the claim was actually made in 2019, all they would be able to get is fees incurred after 2019, and everybody agrees that there weren't any because the case was over. Relation back doesn't retroactively create coverage for work that's done before an actual claim is asserted.
How many legal fees were paid after this 2019? You're saying nothing or just a small amount, or how much?
Well, you might have to ask Springstone that, but I believe that the answer is zero, because by 2019, the case had already been dismissed. So I'm not sure how they could possibly spend money defending a case that had already been dismissed. So I guess, Your Honors, I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Our position on coverage B is that there's no claim against an individual because nobody was ever identified in writing as someone who might be charged. There's no allegation of a wrongful act, and there's no reimbursement. Our position under coverage C for the subpoena is that it's not a claim for a wrongful act based on ProMedica, and that even if it was a claim against Springstone for non-monetary relief, we have an exclusion in the policy, which specifically says that for under coverage C, Hiscox shall pay no loss on account of any claim seeking non-monetary relief from the company. And the district court properly relied on that. Even if there was a claim against Springstone seeking non-monetary relief under coverage C, we have an exclusion that's right on point. There's not really much of an argument in response to that, other than the claim, well, maybe that makes coverage illusory, but it doesn't, because under Kentucky law...
Duffy, I see your time is up.
I apologize, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vance, you have your rebuttal. You can't hear you.
Apologies. Sorry, I'll start with your hypothetical, Judge Sutton, and to say the response you got back was that wouldn't be a claim either. Well, it reminds me of an insurance professor in law school who used to say about insurance companies, hey, we're an insurance company. We collect premiums. We don't pay claims. That's exactly what's going on here. if you look at the coverage parts, there very clearly is
coverage. So let me ask you one of your malpractice occurrence cases. You leave the sponge in. Your client goes to the attorney. The attorney sends in a subpoena in 2020 for the medical records. And then he doesn't do anything. And then in 2021, he starts a lawsuit. Two different insurance companies. Under an occurrence made, which insurance company is liable? The one under 2020 or the one under 2021?
Well, Judge Sir Heinrich, I think it's a fact-based inquiry because it's if you're talking about a private, first of all, I'm not sure how a private individual.
Well, we're talking about the legal meaning of the word claim.
Sure.
And one is what happened in 2020 was investigatory. What happened in 2021 was a lawsuit, and that's the claim, right?
But here what you have is a written demand for non-monetary relief. They're asking for a benefit to be conferred in providing the information, and they're saying that's in it is.
But it's still a claims-made policy.
Yes, it's a claims-made policy. And we are arguing that the claim is made either at the time of service of the subpoena or at the time of the unsealing and delivering of the QI-TAM complaint, or both. In fact, we think it's both, under depending on whether you're looking at coverage B or coverage C. And I want to say something about this idea that it's no claim with respect to the QI-TAM complaint. Well, if that's the case, then and it wouldn't relate back and wouldn't have fees. First of all, there's nothing in the record about fees, so I don't know where Mr. Duffy's getting that information. We're at the 12B6 stage. But if you look at Hiscox's notice of circumstances, it says, we acknowledge, we're denying coverage, and we think they're wrong about that, but we're denying coverage, but we acknowledge that the facts here are such that they could subsequently ripen into a claim. And if that happens, let us know. We did, and they still denied coverage. There's no question that the QI-TAM complaint itself makes a demand. It's in writing, and it makes a demand for monetary relief. And that's what the Delaware court said in the Medical Depot case, that an unserved QI-TAM complaint under those circumstances does constitute a claim for relief. So we believe that the district court erred in prematurely terminating this case, and we respectfully request that, that decision be reversed and it be remanded for consistent proceedings.
Thank you to both of you for your helpful briefs and arguments. I, for one, am always grateful when I get an insurance case and I have great lawyers in front of me. So thank you for your guidance. Very helpful. And, the case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the next case. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honor.